From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. There's plenty of lamenting these days about America's political divide, but our guest today says in order to narrow the gap, we all need to put politics in its proper place. That means, he says, deliberately seeking out activities that have nothing to do with politics and where you're likely to engage with people who hold different views than your own. Today in The Exchange, we're talking with political philosopher Robert Talese. He's a professor at Vanderbilt University and author of many books, including the one that we'll talk about called Overdoing Democracy. Listeners, how do you feel about our nation's political divides and your own role in perpetuating them? Are you feeling saturated in politics right now? Or do you think paying attention is more important than ever? We welcome your questions. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. And Professor Robert Talese joins us from Nashville. Professor Talese, nice to have you on The Exchange. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It's great to be here.
So what does it mean to overdo democracy? I haven't heard that term before until I read your book.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. So, we have the idea that good things can be overdone in almost every other area of life. You know, we have the idea of a workaholic, somebody who's so devoted to their work, and let's just presume that their job is important and socially produces socially good things, but there's still a sense in which one can overdo a good thing. And what got me thinking about the book was that, well, maybe democracy is that kind of good. Namely, maybe it's the kind of thing that it's possible to do too much of it in a way that makes us actually less good at being democratic citizens.
Wow. So too much of it actually is a bad thing, like over-exercising, overeating, overworking. So where does the line fall? And this is what a lot of workaholics probably ask themselves, Professor Talese, so I appreciate the analogy. Where does the line fall between doing it well and overdoing it?
So it's a tricky line to draw, and I think that it varies depending on different people's social contexts. But here's one sort of feature of the problem. As our country has gotten more diverse in the aggregate, that is in the whole, the spaces that you and I inhabit in our day-to-day lives have become more homogeneous. So the diversity has flourished in the country, but each of our little slices of the political and social world have become more alike. And that alikeness is more and more organized around our partisan or political identities. And so part of what it is to overdo democracy is to allow our political allegiances and loyalties to shape and organize the entirety of our social lives, such that where we buy our groceries and how we spend our weekends and where we vacation, so on and so forth, have all become ways of expressing and communicating our political allegiances, which means that we spend more and more time interacting only with people who are just like ourselves politically. That's bad for democracy because democracy runs on disagreement.
Well, and I want to ask you a lot of questions about, you know, this political sorting that you talk about and all that and how that's happening in ways seen and unseen. But a couple more questions just on this notion of overdoing it. How does that square, Professor Talese, with the idea of an engaged citizenry, you know, that you need to know what's going on?
Sure. So I agree with most, I think most citizens, and certainly most political philosophers and democratic theorists, that democracy needs an engaged, active citizenry. That is part of what makes the project of collective self-government work is people engaged actively in self-government. So the thesis that it's possible to overdo democracy and that, in fact, we in the United States are overdoing it is to be distinguished from a nearby, but I think untrue claim, which is that, you know, politics is all small stuff and don't sweat the small stuff. There are better things to do with your life than worry about politics. I'm not committed to that claim. I think that politics is really important and that we need to be engaged and active citizens. The overdoing democracy thesis is the slightly different claim, which is that amidst all of our political engagement and interaction and activism even, we need also to do other things. We need to find cooperative social endeavors in which politics plays no part. We need to find things to do together, not where we're reaching across the aisle or trying to suppress our political differences. I mean, we could do a little of that too. I'm not opposed to that. But the thesis is that we need to find things to do together in which politics is just not part of the activity. Note that reaching across the aisle and the other kinds of metaphors we use for political cooperation across differences all keep politics at the center of the activity. In fact, reaching across the aisle literally puts politics at right. the center of the activity. What I want to suggest is that, well, in addition to being active and engaged citizens, we also need to do something else if we're going to perform well democratically. We need to find things to do together, not where we're suppressing our political differences, but in which our political differences are just not part of the activity. They're as irrelevant to what we're doing as the color of the walls on our bank, you know? And that we struggle to imagine what kind of activity that could be is a symptom of our overdoing democracy, that our political aims and objectives have infiltrated our conception of everything that we could possibly do together that would be worthwhile. That's a signal that we've overdone it. In fact, I would say, yeah, that's what a workaholic is too. A workaholic is somebody who sees his work or her work in every little activity that happens throughout his or her day. Similarly, we overdo democracy when everything we can think of doing with and in the presence of others becomes for us a way of signaling or communicating or advancing our political objectives. And it turns out that when politics is all we ever do together, we get bad at it.
Because we're not listening or understanding people who hold different political views.
Well, there's that. And we're subject to certain kinds of cognitive forces that erode our capacity, not merely to listen to the other side, which is a crucial capacity to be sure, but we're subject to cognitive forces that erode our ability to even recognize that there is another side. We come more increasingly inclined to see our political opponents as merely obstacles, not even opponents, right? There are people who aren't engaged in the same, they seem to us to be people not even engaged in the same project that we are engaged in. Our political opponents come to strike us as unworthy of democratic citizenship. Now, it just seems to me that to invite and nurture the attitude that only those people who hold the views that I'm comfortable with are worthy of democratic citizenship, that strikes me as a fundamentally anti-democratic attitude. But that's the attitude that's encouraged in us when everything we do is politics.
I want to run an example by you that I came across this morning, Professor Talese, that I'm wondering if this kind of fits in with what you just said. So Danny Meyer, famous restaurant guy, opened up a whole bunch of famous restaurants, you know, Gramercy Tavern, Union Square Cafe, the Shake Shack burger chain. On Saturday, hours after the presidential election had been called for Joe Biden, Meyer was, I'm reading from the Washington Post here, once again playing the gracious host, offering a, quote, virtual hug to those on the losing side and encouraging the victors to embrace the moment. Time for all of us to show the virtue of leading with hospitality, Meyer added in his tweet. Much hard work to do, many big problems to solve. Nothing possible without a place at the table for all. The idea didn't go over well with those on the left, though, the Post says. One tweet, for example, and there were lots of tweets like this, there's no room at my table for haters. So I just wonder what that says to you, Professor Talese. you're calling for people to do stuff with, sit down with people who feel differently, saying that overall that will improve our society. Sure. But it seems like a lot of people aren't interested.
So good. I would say that that kind of reaction is a symptom. In fact, it confirms the diagnosis that seeing everything as a life and death struggle, not with my fellow citizens who have different political views from me, views that I think are false, but there's nonetheless my fellow citizens. We've given up that attitude and taken on this different kind of political posture, which is the posture that says my political opponents are not properly citizens. My political opponents, in virtue of their disagreement with my politics, are for that reason failures at democracy and unworthy of equal citizenship. That's fundamentally, it strikes me, an anti-democratic posture, no matter who's taking it. And so the idea that the other side, and in the example that you gave, we were thinking about liberal citizens seeing the losers, in this case, the Republicans, as haters. Seeing the other side as a monolith that embraces a single idea, in this case, a single attitude, hatred, that is beyond a rational discourse, that cannot be understood even, or is not even worth trying to understand why they've got the political views that they do, depraved as we think those views may be. Those are all fundamentally non-democratic attitudes. If democracy is anything, it's the hypothesis, it's the proposal that ordinary citizens can achieve a relatively just and stable political order, a decent society, in the absence of rulers and bosses and kings, because democracy says ordinary citizens can govern themselves as equals. But if we're committed to the idea of self-government as equals, we must also be committed to the idea of self-government among people who sometimes, perhaps often, profoundly disagree about politics, because that's just one of the upshots of equality. If we are equal citizens, part of what equality means in this context is we each get to exercise our own judgment about politics. We get to make up our own minds. When you've got a group of people together, each of whom gets to make up his or her own mind about something important, you're going to get diverging viewpoints and judgments. So democracy is the commitment to self-government among political equals who disagree. And once we adopt the attitude that those with whom we disagree are merely haters, people not even worth engaging with, we've given up on democracy.
Wow, that's a pretty big statement, Professor Talese.
I try.
Well, I want to invite our listeners to join us and see what they think about all this. And then we have a lot more to talk about, including media saturation, social media, and so forth. So, Exchange listeners, it's your turn. Our phone number, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. We want your thoughts on the political divides we see in America, where they come from, and what our own roles are in perpetuating these divides. Our guest is political philosopher Robert Talese, a professor at Vanderbilt, the author of many books, including the one we're talking about right now called Overdoing Democracy. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Use Facebook, use Twitter, or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Professor Talese, what role does the ubiquity of media, including social media, just information every single time you you go anywhere, what does that play in all this?
Well, good. So, you know, there's a, I think by now, familiar concern about social media being a tool that we individually use to curate our informational environments, such that, you know, one of the things social media platforms do is they allow us to, sometimes very consciously, sometimes with algorithms unconsciously, allows us to select in advance the kind of information we'll be exposed to, the kind of news we'll be exposed to, who our interlocutors or, you know, sort of conversation partners, such as they may be on social media, will be. And so part of what social media does is it empowers us as individuals to shape our own environment, including our informational environment. And now the common concern about that, which I share, is that social media platforms enable individual users to filter out and to expel from their informational environment any disconfirming or uncomfortable or even opposing viewpoint or messaging. And what that means is that as users use social media and more increasingly get their news, including their political news, from social media, individuals come to embrace an increasingly narrow conception of what's going on in the world, increasingly politically narrow conception, where they hear only a particular political interpretation of world events. And so what that means is that we become more convinced of those particular pieces of information or that kind of reporting or the perspective from which that website or news channel delivers the news. We become more convinced of it, and we become less able to recognize messaging and reportage that doesn't conform to our expectations. We become less able to recognize those as legitimate reports. We become more likely to dismiss them. We become more promptly to see them as fake news or as propaganda. But as it turns out, I should say, maybe this is not surprising, but sometimes it helps for it to be said, you know, politics is not easy. What goes on in the political world, even in the relatively local political world of individual states, let alone the national stage or even the international stage, this is complicated. Politics is complicated. It should come as no surprise to us that with respect to any particular political event or happening, there's lots to say about it. There are lots of different ways of describing even what happened. And as citizens, we have to figure out, we have to navigate that complexity. It turns out that social media and the media environment, such as it's developed, now provides us with a mechanism by which what is complex and what rightly prompts thought and reflection is now delivered to us in highly simplistic, easily digestible pieces that require no reflection whatsoever. That, again, strikes me as a blow against proper citizenship. The idea and the promoting of the attitude that politics is simple.
Wow. I have a couple questions for you about that, Professor Talese, but let's go to our listeners now. And sure. Sharon's calling in Exeter. Hi, Sharon. Thanks for being on the air with us today.
Hi. Thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
I want to say that I think Professor Talese's thesis is very sound, and it really is an important thing, especially now when we've been so factionalized that we've got to find a way to pull ourselves together. And it means really trying to understand why the other party is so upset. So I think it's really good, but it also strikes me that this thesis coming up at this moment, after we've been through this crisis in our democracy, which really took over my life. I just feel like it's really important to say that this thesis cannot be generalized and that there are lots of generalizations that can't be applied to this past 4 years and this past election.
So what do you mean by that, Sharon? At first you said you're on board with what the professor says, but then you're saying this doesn't apply to right now?
No, well, I think it's kind of ambiguous, but what I mean to be saying is that there is definitely a way that this message, meeting other people, being responsible in your part in democracy, being a good citizen, those things are essential. But what we just went through seems to me a very clear demonstration of the opposite. And so what we have now is, I feel safer, say, in the newly elected president, but I also feel that we have to find a way to say to the people who supported the sort of behavior that we saw in our president, in Trump, we have to find a way to reach those people and make them part of our party, make us all part of the democracy. And I think that's what Dr. Tilson's saying, but I also feel like this past election was an extreme. We had an extreme example of an undemocratic behavior from our president and undemocratic behavior from his followers, and led to violence in some cases. So does that make it a little more clear what I'm talking
about?
Yeah,
Sharon, thank you very much for calling in. It's great to hear from you. And Professor Talese, is a lot there. One thing that sure. I'm so struck by from Sharon's comment, because I've heard it from other listeners, you know, she felt like politics in recent years has taken over her life. Not that she wanted it to, but it just kind of did. You write about the ubiquity of politics. It's everywhere. We're saturated. Right. What about that, Professor Talese?
So, yeah, let me say one, I feel with Sharon the same sort of set of attitudes and even some of the conflict that that she was giving voice to. So let me say one very general thing that I think is non-controversial, but we'll see. You know, it's the mark of of authoritarian regimes that everything is politics. That is a sure signal that you are living under a dictator, when every little choice you make, the kind of car you drive, you know, what music you listen to, how you spend your weekend time off, when all of that is seen as political and as warranting political evaluation, that is how dictatorial regimes operate. They politicize everything. Now, it strikes me that our own society, even though it is a democracy, has sort of started edging in that direction, where in both ways that are conscious and unconscious, our lives from the moment we wake up until the moment we go to bed are constantly, we're constantly being summoned to express and to live and to communicate and to stand up for our political values. Now, again, let me reiterate, democracy is a spectator sport. We need to be engaged, you know, citizens. Politics is serious stuff. So I'm not saying, oh, we shouldn't be doing politics. It's just that when that takes over, as Sharon put it, when that takes everything over, when that becomes the sole point of it all, not only do I think we lose our sense of the value of democracy, which after all, part of the value of democracy is that it creates a relatively just and free social order in which individuals can go pursue things other than politics. I mean, you know, part of what makes democracy so good is that you can go devote your life to jigsaw puzzles if you want. You still have to do the work of citizenship, but when, you know, when the work of citizenship is done, you can go and pursue something that has nothing to do with, you can be a gardener, right? You can take up hobbies. You can do all kinds of things, right? So that everything has become a way of doing politics. We sort of lost our sense of what the value of the whole enterprise is, which is to create a social order in which you can devote your life to other things in addition to politics. The other edge of it, though, is that when everything becomes politics, when politics takes over our lives, we become, just to repeat, we become less good at it. And let me just add one other sort of detail to this, because as Sharon said, one might wonder, and I think legitimately so, given what the country has just gone through and in some ways is still going through, it's like, why should I try to make peace with my political opponents? After all, my political opponents seem divested from democracy. My political opponents seem to be invested in the idea that elections that they don't win are rigged for that, by that reason, rigged. Why should I try to make any common cause with them when they seem already to have their head out of the game? I think that's a valid concern. Let me just give one additional sort of detail of the story that Sharon might appreciate. When we decline or withdraw from the project of trying to uphold the norms of democratic citizenship, even with our political enemies, that is, when we cut loose from our political opponents, when we write them off as incapable of good citizenship and uninterested in civility, when we demonize them as anti-democratic, as a monolith of people who are out to steal elections, so on and so forth. Not only do we break civic relations with anyone who's not just like us, which I think is bad for us, but also the forces of division and factionalism don't go away. They turn inward. That is, when we break off healthy democratic relations with people who we oppose politically, when we no longer engage with the opposition, what happens to our political alliances is that they start to factionalize. That is, we become less able to maintain our political friendships when we break off democratic relations with our political opponents. And we see this happen a lot, right? In the absence of a healthy opposition, it's not just politics either. In the absence of a healthy opposition, the group splinters. And when the group splinters, it shrinks. And when the group shrinks, it becomes politically less efficacious in a democracy. So we kind of subvert our own political ends, right? We kind of subvert our own political friendships, yeah, right? When we break off relations with our political opponents.
Well, and, you know, Lincoln said it best, right? A house divided against itself cannot stand. So if it seems incredibly difficult to, you know, not just stay in your own little political silo, you're saying, you know, don't do it for the other person, do it for yourself and for the health the country. We have to take a very quick break, Professor Talese. And when we come back, we've got some more calls and emails that I'd love to get to. So, Sharon, thank you very much for that one. Join us, listeners, this concept of overdoing democracy. Our guest says, when we do politics too much, we become less good. So we're going to dig into this more in just a minute. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
NHPR 2020 has been quite the year, and thanks to listener support, NHPR was right there with you through it all. Become an NHPR sustaining member today at $13 a month or through a one-time gift of $156, and your gift will mean more timely, accurate information available to everyone. Plus, at that level, we're going to send you a pair of merino wool NHPR branded socks, courtesy of Minus 33 in Ashland, New Hampshire. Make your year-end tax-deductible gift at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, are we overdoing democracy and, as our guest says, in the process, undermining it? That's what political philosopher Robert Talese says in his new book and his TED Talk, Overdoing Democracy. By the way, we have links to all of that on our website. It's nhpr.org/exchange. So listeners, let's hear from you. Are you perhaps overdoing it on politics? What's your own role in terms of bridging America's political divides? Our number 1-800-892-6477, and our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Professor Talese, here's an interesting email from Phil in Loudoun, who says, to overcome this tribalism that threatens our democracy, I would suggest a plan for mandatory national service for all high school graduates. Military basic training works to overcome social, religious, and racial intolerance by identifying a common enemy, tribalism, Russia, China, climate change, pandemics and other national disasters, etc., and then unifying to overcome it where the mission is more important than the individual. Phil, thank you so much for writing in. And Professor Talese, what do you think?
So this idea of a national service requirement is very compelling to me, whether it needs to be on the model of military training or not is a different kind of issue. I'm not so convinced as Phil is of that, but it's not new, and it strikes me as a good idea. Let me just add, though, one thing. So the idea of a mandatory national service, although I find it a compelling thought, still runs the risk of making politics the center of it all. And in fact, in some of the examples that Phil just listed about having to identify a common enemy, some of them are political enemies, not merely just sort of large scale global problems like global warming. So I understand the appeal and feel the appeal, but here's an additional thought. You know, it wasn't more than 30 years ago in the United States where it was very common in individuals' social lives, as a matter of course, to just have interactions, planned and unplanned, casual and less casual, with others who were different from them socioeconomically, politically, and in all kinds of other respects. But nonetheless, have those interactions in contexts where their differences were just not central to the interaction. And I'm thinking particularly about bowling leagues, for example, in the United States. Turns out that a sociologist by the name of Robert Putnam,
who lives sort of part-time in New Hampshire and yes, has been on the show a number of times. Yes.
Oh, good, good. So you know what I'm about to say.
Oh, yeah.
Good, yeah. So we still bowl. It's just we don't do it in contexts that put us in touch with people we haven't already chosen to be our partners in the activity. And if you look across American society, from our workplaces and our neighborhoods, our congregations, our schools, even occupations like dentistry and surgeon. These have all become politically sorted such that our neighborhoods, our congregations, and our workplaces, there are the Republican districts, the Republican neighborhoods, the Republican or conservative congregations, and then there are separate parts of the city where the liberals live, where the liberals drink their coffee and buy their groceries. And so in all of these subtle ways, occasions for pro-social interaction among people who are quite different, but their differences are not the focus of the interaction. These have receded, and we've become more and more a society where interaction with people who are unlike us is interactions that is focused on the differences, rather than a case in which some social interactions are just like, we don't know whether we're different or not. You're just sure. Standing behind me online at a grocery store. Turns out that grocery stores, different grocery store franchises, lean heavily according to partisan identity. Dunkin' Donuts and Starbucks. Starbucks leans heavily liberal. Dunkin' Donuts skews heavily conservative. And so little pieces of our everyday social lives are already sorted and segregated according to partisan divides, so that the very thing that Phil is suggesting, that we need to find commonality, is true. But it also seems that we're living in a society that is already structured around the idea that we can't bridge differences, and that when we're dealing with people who are different, we must be focused on the difference. Which
Instead
strikes
of
me
the
again
activity
very,
that we're focused on. Yeah, and in a few minutes, Professor Taliso, I want to ask you about what places or activities or organizations might remain. I'm thinking kids' sports, maybe that's one area. But let's go back to our listeners. Heidi's calling from Francistown. Hi, Heidi. Thanks for being with us on The Exchange.
Hi. Thank you. I'd just like to say that I support the professor completely. I think that you really are saying things that are very, very important for people to hear. And yes, it is true, we have been pushed away from democracy, everything has become political. And just one hideous example, of course, is what happened with mask wearing. A matter of health becomes something political, and that people are resisting that sort of thing. And I've found for myself that not so much myself, but I think that this has been generally true, that we've had to resist being broken into warring camps. And I've found that it's so important to keep in contact with other people, not just that there's more to life than politics, but that we need each other, and that we're in trouble. In a way, we're in danger if we find ourselves surrounded by people we can't talk to. We're surrounded by enemies, and I think that it's terribly important for people to keep talking to each other, to keep up the social relations, the friendly relations, the neighborly relations, because what has happened with our president is that he has become a cult figure, and there's been what cult figures do so well.
Well, Heidi, how do you do it? I'm interested in what you say. It's so important to reach out to other people, to maintain friendships and relationships with people who feel differently.
Yeah.
And it sounds like you're trying. So how do you do it? Like, in what spaces do you still...
Well, I don't find it such a terrible effort. I find that, first of all, I don't have any political secrets. I'm an open book. Everybody knows that I belong to the Democratic Committee. I write letters to the Ledger. They get published. And still, I just am in touch with people. I keep in touch with people, and these are my neighbors, my friends, and I don't try to convert people. But I think that somehow this keeping in touch with people is going to help break a kind of spell that cult figures have a kind of bewitching power over people. That's their power. They don't necessarily do anything for them or help them. They just somehow draw them in.
Well, and, Heidi, it's great to hear from you. Yeah, and Professor Talese, go ahead. What do you think?
Yeah, so I think Heidi's right in that one of the consequences, and I think, again, a consequence, this is a consequence that's bad for democracy. But one of the consequences of all the tribalism and polarization of the American citizenry, which is heavily tribal and heavily polarized. By the way, the American citizenry is, we feel more divided than we've ever been, despite the fact that when it comes to actual policy preferences, we are no more divided than we were in the 80s, which is, so it's
wow,
almost.
That's a revelation.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, you know, in fact, you know, when you think about the sort of staple culture war issues of the 80s and even the 90s, these are just not things that people, you know, gay marriage, for example, stem cell research, for example, these are not the, you know, in fact, the American citizenry has moderated. They've moved closer together on those two issues. They've become more liberal as a citizenry. We've become more liberal as a country on those two issues. So we are far more, we seem to one another to be far more distant politically than in fact we are. And just to speak to Heidi's point, one of the consequences of this segregation that feeds that misperception of what the other side is like is that as society partitions us off into our like-minded enclaves, we come to get our image, our understanding, our conception of the other side from our own side. And that's toxic. When you get your view about what the opponent is like from not the opponent themselves, but from your friends, lo and behold, you wind up with a distorted conception of what the other side is like, because you're getting your information from a group of people who are consciously or unconsciously motivated and incentivized to amplify the differences between the good guys and the bad guys, our group and their group. In fact, you know, the more you look into some of the group dynamics that drive this, the more you realize the funny, but also in some ways tragic fact, you know, adult human beings aren't that much different from 16-year-olds in high school. It's a lot of clique behavior where you find out who the cool kids are and then figure out ways to make fun of the kids who aren't cool. That's kind of what goes on in politics at a much higher stakes level, unfortunately.
Well, let's take another call. And yeah. Heidi, thank you. It's great to hear your thoughts. Megan's calling in from Exeter. Hi, Megan. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi. I've had the good fortune of being able to work in a lot of different industries, one being factories. And so I think we all hopefully know at this point the polls are wrong. So talking about whether people accept abortion or stem cell research, polls are just, we've seen this in presidential elections twice now, are inaccurate. And having worked in those positions myself, right now I'm a mental health counselor, so that's a very diverse from being in a factory. So I've been able to see a lot of different kinds of people and what they do and how they think. And I might really like that guy who's in shipping, but his views are dramatically different than my own, and I can get along with him on the job. But I think that these things are real, and the reason that there is such a divide is because in some ways, yes, we are more divided by all the things we see on social media, but we're also, in some ways, we're more informed. And I think part of the problem is that both of these sides see each other as being supportive of a certain kind of abuse. So for the most part, you'll see people on the liberal side as thinking that the other side supports abuse against social issues, gay marriage, different topics that are more social on that end. And then you'll see if you look into, because I'm all over the, I'm so into psychology, I'm all over the place on Facebook looking at different opinions, that the other side is making up, you know, stuff like Pizzagate, where they're talking about this idea of Hillary Clinton drinking the blood of children and things like that, thinking that our side is about child abuse and that we accept that. So you have, you know, that the last caller had mentioned about cult, and you really do have these two sides building the other side up as this really evilly abusive force.
Megan, so I'm so interested in what you have to say. Yeah. So tell me, as a mental health professional, and good for you for doing that, because there's a shortage for sure in New Hampshire. How do you even sort through that to reach some of the ideas that Professor Talese talks about, which is, these are human beings, and when we demonize them, we are, in fact, undermining our own democracy and undermining our own self-interest for a healthy country.
Well, it is tough being in mental health because, you know, I consider myself an independent, and I'm very, I like the conversation. I'm in this job for a reason. I like being able to talk to people with different opinions and seeing why they have these opinions. But sometimes I'll come across someone who's really will express themselves, and I can't do any, it's not my job to change a person to believe what I want to believe.
Of course not.
But it's
yeah.
It is fascinating to hear what people say and knowing their history, and people are coming from these terribly abusive circumstances. I'm in Lynn, so my population is very diverse. And it's just interesting to see that everybody has a background. You know, we all are coming from a place where we've had experiences in life. I just did this research survey on people's abuse history of being bullied in school and how we perceive the other side as being bullies or supporting us from not being bullied, and people we care about and ideas we think about is who's being bullied, who's being abused. And I think until that is kind of like a common ground place, like, yeah, it's a great idea that I can go out and put together a puzzle and maybe like relax from the world. But there are real things going on. And until
it's
we
profound.
As a society, yeah. like look at the abuse, the things that we can commonly get together to address real issues and not just, yeah. you know, we all need to relax. Absolutely. We all need our time away or it just gets worse and worse. But there are real things going on, real abuses. Mm-hmm. And we have to look at those.
Megan, that's a great point. And I'm sorry to jump in on you, but I have to take a very quick station break. And when we come back, Let's pick up on that, Professor Talese, the idea that, yes, we need a break from politics. Yes, we can overdo politics. But, you know, Megan's making a profound point that there are really deep-seated issues and fears here that do need to be addressed. So we'll pick up that thread after break and take more of your comments. Stay on the line. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. This hour, political philosopher Robert Talese and why he thinks we're overdoing democracy and how so much political engagement, he says, is actually making our politics worse. Now, one of his prescriptions is getting involved with activities or causes that have nothing to do with politics. So listeners, what do you think? How much of this are you able to do in your own life? How much do you want to do this? Let us know. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Comment on Facebook, tweet us, call 1-800-892-6477. And Professor Talese, really quickly, because we've got a lot more people who want to jump into our conversation, which is great, but what about Megan's point? Yes, we all need to take a break from politics, but there is some fundamental stuff going on that, you know, we need to address.
Sure, I couldn't agree more. And again, the thesis is not that we need to withdraw from politics. Again, I maintain that democracy requires an active and engaged citizenry. We have to do something in addition to politics is the thought. Now, one of the things that Megan emphasized, which I thought was very insightful, is the need to see, not merely, not merely to see the other side's position, not merely to listen to the other side's political ideas, but to see them as coming from somewhere, to see them as driven by a certain set of experiences, a certain history, a certain kind of background. And we need to turn those very same tools on ourselves. We often, and it often feels to us as if our political opinions are the deliverances directly of facts and logic, when in fact, we have all kinds of good psychological, not only philosophical reasons to say that. No, our political views and our political thinking are deeply driven by our histories, our background, where we've come from socially and in other respects as well. And so seeing that our views have these roots in our own sort of social background is an important step in understanding other people. You don't, in order to understand another person, it's not enough just to comprehend what they say. You have to be able to tell a relatively accurate story of why they're saying it. And until we start seeing it, it's not just that people who disagree with me are saying what they're saying because they're crazy or depraved or child molesters or, you know, zombies or whatever, which is part of the discourse today, I'm sad to say. But to say, well, what they're saying might still be wrong, but I can understand why somebody might be attracted to a view that strikes me as false.
Well, that's why it's great to hear from. That's what's great to hear from Megan, because as a therapist, she understands, you know, the depths of people's experiences and what's driving it. So back to the calls, people really jumping in on this topic, and it's great. Michael's joining us from Nashua. Michael, you're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Oh, hey, great. Thanks so much for having me on.
Sure.
I just wanted to make a plug, perhaps just maybe seconding the argument that's already been made about volunteering. So I work at the Nashua Soup Kitchen and Shelter, and before the pandemic anyway, we had thousands of people coming in to volunteer over the course of the year, and I'm pretty sure that nobody ever asked the other volunteer whether they were Republican or Democrat. It was more, you know, where does this can of beans go, or can I get some more eggs to serve on the line, things like that. And I think that making, you know, when you're volunteering, it takes these abstract ideas and makes them very real. And that in the process of creating that reality, you know, perhaps it softens the edges. Like when we're only talking in abstract, we can go to extremes in a way that you really can't when you have a real human being in front of you. I know that this past week when we were giving out boxes for Thanksgiving, you know, when you had an older gentleman come in who had a hard time walking and a volunteer helped carry that box out, or a family came in with young kids, you know, everybody's eyes just lit up and said, oh, wow, that's why I'm here.
Yeah. Michael, that's great. It's great to hear from you. And before I get your thoughts, Professor Talese, I also want to talk to Maddie in Newport. So, Maddie, you're on the exchange too. Go ahead. Maddie, you're there. Okay, I guess we don't have Maddie on the line. So, Michael, Professor Talese, got to exactly what you conclude your book with, which is get out there and make civic friendships. So, go ahead, Professor Talese.
Sure. So I couldn't agree more with the spirit of what Michael has said. It seems to me that volunteering is a natural and I think quite effective way to operationalize, to sort of live the idea that there's more to life to politics, and pursuing that extra social good that's beyond politics is a way of becoming a better citizen. I mean, that's the thesis of the book, in fact. Now, let me just say one very quick thing. When I started writing the book and started giving some public lectures about these topics, a questioner in the Q&A session asked me, you know, what should we go and do? You know, you've convinced me I need to do something in addition to living my politics in order to be more authentically a democratic citizen. But what kind of thing should I do? And I gave an answer that was almost like Michael's. I said, well, why don't you volunteer to clean up litter from the local park? We were at the lecture was across the street from a park. And the response that the questioner gave me was, well, that would be a liberal thing to do. Which, again, I said, look, that's an interesting symptom. The idea that volunteering is itself a political partisan act is not entirely absent from the mind of the American, of some American citizens, at least. But I think Michael is right that finding ways to engage together with people in pro-social contexts where we can focus on social goods that are not already coded according to our partisan identities is really where it's at. Unless we do that, our democratic capacities will further deteriorate. In particular, now let me just say a political philosopher thing. I think that what Michael was getting at, one of the benefits that Michael was recognizing in his comment, is that when we interact with others in some cooperative way for some pro-social end, in a context where we're not aware of their political leanings, we come to see one another as dependable neighbors, kind individuals, caring. We come to see one another's virtues in a way that's not immediately tied to their partisan identities. And seeing one another as manifesting virtues is one way of getting over the tribalism that infiltrates our politics.
Couple more emails I'd love to share with you, Professor Talese. Victor writes, doesn't race play a role right now in how people feel about politics? I think it does. And Trump in the presidency proves it for me, Victor says. He brought out to light everything that is wrong in America, inequality across the board for those in minority groups. And, you know, I wanted to ask you this, Professor Talese. At some level, isn't saying, you know, disengage from politics easier to say, or not disengage, but make politics less central to your life? Is that easier to say when you are coming from a point of privilege?
So let me first say in response to Victor, I agree with all of that, that it seems to me that one of the ways in which our democracy is failing at the ideal of collective self-government among equals is by way of the radical inequalities, social, economic inequalities with respect to access to basic goods like healthcare and so on. So I agree with all of that. And that's certainly a broader view about sort of building a better democracy will have to be in large part about those inequalities. This is an analysis, though, that I think helps us to get some explanation as to how some of the ways in which we got to where we are, and helps us to see one dimension of the problem that we're facing when we seek to make progress in these ways. If we can't see one another as political equals, it's no mystery to me why we have a hard time pressing for political changes that would better manifest political equality. So now let me address your question, Laura. Now, it might be true that the challenge of doing something in addition to politics depends upon social privilege. But it seems to me that those of us who enjoy those privileges should have a heavier burden for democracy.
Professor Talese, we could have talked for another 3 hours. I really appreciate you being here. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me.
That's Robert Talese. He's a philosophy professor at Vanderbilt University and author of many books on politics and polarization, including the one we talked about today called Overdoing Democracy. And we have links to his work and to his TED Talk on our website. It's nhpr.org/exchange. Today's show was produced by Exchange producer and NHPR news host Jessica Hunt. Again, our website is nhpr.org/exchange for more information. Thanks for being with us. I'm Laura Kanoi, and this is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.